Very well-known passage, Ecclesiastes 3, 1 to 11. If you're married, it's very possible that you had it at your wedding service. It's the sort of service that people like to take Ecclesiastes 4. Here we are then in chapter 3, verses 1 to 11. For everything there is a season and a time, for every matter under heaven. And then this rhythm of activities, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted, and so on. It's been turned into song on various occasions. The full quote, by the way, from Bertrand Russell, from his work, The Study of Mathematics, is, "Real life is to most people a long second best, a perpetual compromise between the ideal and the possible." Well, I don't know what you make of that quote. In many ways, we must agree. We'd agree especially if we adopt Bertrand Russell's philosophical stance as an atheist, which he was all of his life, so that if this life is all, then for millions and millions of people, not only in Romania but in many other parts of the world, including this country, life will be pretty humdrum, pretty second rate, and won't have very much to offer in terms of health or security or wealth or promotion, recognition, fulfillment. Real life, he says, is to most people a long second best, a perpetual compromise between the ideal and the possible. And then the writer of the Ecclesiastes would perhaps tend to agree with him. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. That's the great phrase that recurs in this book. Not that Christians would follow along that line of reasoning. We recognize that life is never going to be perfect in this world. But we also recognize that there's another world. And that as far as God is concerned, this life that we are pitched into now can never, ever be anything else than second best. Just a pale shadow of the perfect life which we are beckoned to. We recognize that if we are believers at all. And then those of us, and there are hundreds of us, who have stumbled or been led into the Christian faith at some X point in life. We would also want to say that we know what it is to have started living a life that is to take us into friendship with God forever. And that even in this life, we have become, to our amazement, inheritors of eternal life. So in that sense, we cannot call it simply second best what we're into. Though on many occasions, we would only recognize what we've come from because of what we've come into now, looking back in retrospect. We find ourselves dazzled by the grace of God that's come to us. You may remember the incident one August when, do you remember that story of that girl's secretary? It was all over the front pages of the papers. Her name was Sarah Lambert, who made headline news on TV and in the press, when, if you recall, she went missing for several days, a secretary. She'd been victim of a con trick perpetrated by a glib businessman. A nationwide search was set up for Sarah Lambert, and eventually the girl was found in a somewhat confused state at Basingstoke railway station, alone. Evidently, she'd been completely unaware of the hue and cry for her. In her own words at the press conference, she admitted, "I didn't know I was lost until I was found." And it seems to me that her words express very well what many of us have felt on a spiritual level when in our different ways we have at last discovered the Christian faith to be true. And we've accepted it. Up to then, we didn't quite know what we were looking for. And certainly we had no idea that anyone, let alone God, was on a search for us. If anyone had asked us whether we'd lost our way in life, we'd have said, "No, I'm fine. I'm doing all right, not too badly." We'd even got used to the state we were in of not knowing God in a personal sense. It was only when we finally and personally made contact with the Creator through Jesus Christ that the penny dropped and we realized that we had been really in a fog as to the meaning of life and what our existence on this planet was for and who indeed we really were at all. When the jigsaw puzzle is finally resolved and God comes, really comes into our lives, so often it's only then that we say, as Sarah Lambert did, "I didn't know I was lost until I was found." So one of the books in the Bible that sums up this sense of lostness and the meaninglessness of so much of today's Western society is this extraordinary book of Ecclesiastes. I love it. It really comes into its own today because it paints a superb picture of what life is like when God is removed from the canvas. The book stems from the renowned King Solomon, who reigned for 40 fabulous years in the 10th century BC, although the style of Hebrew here, so the boffins tell us, evidently indicates that in the form in which it's come to us, it may actually have been written down somewhat after Solomon's time. But Ecclesiastes serves up for us a marvelous critique of life that has become secularized and devoid of faith in God. People have puzzled over it. Of course, you can romanticize it if you wish. You can turn it into song, as those seekers did in Australia in the 60s. "For everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven." So, I mean, first of all, there is the superficial interpretation. The superficial interpretation, in which the comment would be, "Oh, how attractive. I like the words. I'll write a song on it. A time to be born, a time to die." That's got some romanticism there. Indeed, we'd like to think that there is a rhythm to nature and to life. We say to each other that life would be tedious if we lived in perpetual springtime, so this is very good. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. It feels like a rhythm of security. But if we've got eyes to see, we can observe and we can read between the lines to discern that the philosopher himself, who put these words together, actually represents a view that is at variance with the romantic, superficial interpretation. So we leave the superficial and we look instead at the cynical interpretation. The writer of Ecclesiastes all the time is prodding and pushing his readers, that's you and me, into thinking. He's goading us to ask questions. Because when people begin to ask questions, there really is hope for us. It's the same with pain and disappointment. We don't welcome these things into our lives, but often when they do come, we're set thinking furiously. Pity the person who has never tasted adversity. James Jones tells that story of the Chinese legend where two people, man and his wife, finally had the gift of a child, a little boy. They were so pleased. And then the genie appeared and said, "Ask what you will wish for this child." Oh, they said, "We'll have to think about that." So the genie disappeared and they gave it a week. And when he finally reappeared, they said to the genie, "We have thought what we would like." He said, "Yes, what is it?" "We wish our child never to have any pain at all." "Oh," said the genie, "don't ask for that. Anything, anything but that. Don't ask for that." But they were adamant. They said, "That's what we're going to ask for, that he'll never suffer any pain." The genie disappeared. And happily for the parents, they died before their little boy grew up. Because as the Chinese legend says, he grew up to be a tyrant over the whole of his country. Never felt a thing, never felt any sorrow, never felt any pity or pain or tears or grief. He was a tyrant who brought misery to all of his country. Couldn't feel a thing. Nobody loved him at all. Ecclesiastes is given us to help us to think. What are your circumstances? What are the threads that brought you into London? Why are we here? Let's think about our own lives, where they're going, the sort of people we're becoming. Who are we becoming? It's actually a cynical, unbelieving approach to life that is featured in this astonishing book of Ecclesiastes. There's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, he scribbles in verse 5. A time for war and a time for peace, verse 8. And behind it all is his cynical comment on life itself, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Take God out of the picture, and what are you left with but meaninglessness? It's the great catchword of the book. Life is apparently empty. A time to be born and a time to die. And implicit in this catalogue of seasons and activities is the lurking question, are we being made to dance to a tune? So in between being born and dying, what are we waiting for? In those in-between times, in between loving and hating, in between planting and plucking up, between weeping and laughing, breaking down and building up, what is it all for? Chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes portrays life as an endless circling. Chapter 1, verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Verse 6 of chapter 1, the wind blows to the south and goes round to the north, round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. Verse 9 of chapter 1, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Life is circular in chapter 1. Now here in chapter 3, life is a backwards and forwards affair. Time seems to float us backwards and forwards by tides and currents and seasons that carry us with them, whether or not we want to be carried by them. We're not masters of the situation. We are dancing to a tune. As Tennessee Williams, that turbulent American playwright, once wrote, "What are we sure of? Not even of our existence, dear comforting friend. And whom can we ask the questions that torment us? What is this place? Where are we?" Again and again, it's through the world of the theatre that life as a perpetual second best emerges as the logical conclusion to non-Christian thinking. That famous actor, David Putman, who played Dracula in over 80 films, was asked by a journalist what he thought about life after death. This was David Putnam's reply. "When you are young, you have so many things to think about. Your life, your career, your relationships. There's little time to think about the other end of things. But I've changed as I've grown older. Now it seems to me, as soon as you are born, the only absolutely certain thing is you are going to die. I have to say it is a dismal prospect to think there is no more to it than that, that you go out like a light and that's it. It makes a mockery of the whole purpose of living." Well, I remember when I was talking with a man who was at work here in London, talking about his future. Years ago, he said, "Only 9 more years and then I get my pension." That was how he viewed life. 9 years of struggle, struggle, struggle. Then hopefully a pension. Hopefully a few years of rest before eternity rushed in on him. So Ecclesiastes follows the materialist. He follows the cynic along the lines of their own reasoning. He's pushing his readers along their own roads. He's bending himself in the direction of emptiness and despair and atheism. One long second best. That is what Ecclesiastes is saying. Take out God and that's what you're left with. That's it. So are we programmed simply by genetic inheritance and background and by an impersonal system? Garth Hewitt on occasions has sung here in this church. On the EMI label, his song puts it well. "I saw a man on my TV. He said, 'I wish I could be free. but I'm a victim of my past. And he believed it to the last. Did he jump, or was he pushed? I saw Adam in the garden, wondering should he or should he not. He reached out and took that fruit. Did he jump, or was he pushed? I saw Hitler in his bunker. Blood and pain were all around. What made him cause the fear and hatred? What made him drag his people down? Did he jump, or was he pushed? So it is a serious question with huge implications. And Ecclesiastes, the philosopher, is saying, look at it. From your vantage point, wherever it is, here it is in London, sit down and survey your universe. What did it add up to but a reduction in the stature of humans and the absurdity of a mechanistic universe with words like merit, reward, forgiveness, love, logically obliterated from our vocabulary if God is not there in the picture. Of course, here in London, we know the frustration of ringing somebody on the telephone and being answered by a tape machine. You can't converse with the tape machine, though you find yourself trying to do it at times. Is our universe built on those lines? And are we therefore just a part of nature, locked in with all the animal kingdom? Ecclesiastes puts it to us that we are, as he adopts the cynic's role. Look at chapter 3, verse 18 and 19. I quite like it in the Good News version. He writes there, I concluded that God is testing us to show us that we are no better than animals. After all, the same fate awaits man and animals alike. One dies just like the other. They're both the same kind of creature. A human being is no better off than an animal because life has no meaning for either. That's Ecclesiastes, that's the Bible. But perhaps you say, is that all there is to the message of this book? That humans did not jump, cannot exercise autonomy, choice, that our environment and the system simply push us and squeeze us into the status of a machine or an animal or possibly an accident? We're just dancing to a meaningless tune? It has to be better news than that. And the reason why there are so many hundreds of us here crammed into church is because it is better news. Move on from the superficial interpretation of life and the cynical interpretation to what we may call the spiritual interpretation. Because after all, it is not unrelieved cynicism here in Ecclesiastes. Every now and then, the preacher shows his true colors. His real line, just a tiny hint. He'll pull the curtain back a fraction just to raise the suspicion in the reader that there's more to life than a mere fluctuation of seasons and systems. In fact, why is the philosopher posing these questions at all? The fact that people even ask about the meaning of life is itself a strong pointer to our intended high calling. Look at chapter 3, verse 11, for example. God has made everything beautiful in its time. Then suddenly he pulls the curtain back. Also, he has put eternity into man's mind. So he is different from the animals. So even though we're bound up in time, we're made to realize that there's something more than time. Those verses 10 and 11 demonstrate that this life is a good thing, but it's not an end in itself. There's an eternal factor to be reckoned with, and it's built into men and women. Is it just a long process of getting tired and putting up with second best? No, it isn't. The Christian reminds himself or herself of 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9, the words of Paul, but as it is written, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man conceived, what God has prepared for those who love him, God has revealed to us. There's a different world, different dimension, the spiritual dimension that brings us into touch with the Creator and the Redeemer so that we love him and are able to call him Father. There is a different way of looking at it. The preacher is tantalizing us. The preacher is teasing us at one and the same moment. Yes, life is purposeless until we learn to see it God's way. The tune makes no sense until it beats with the rhythm of eternity and of the gospel of Christ. Even then, we can't understand all of life, as the second half of verse 11 shows. So often we can only see the reverse, the untidy side of God's tapestry and plan. That upsets the materialist very much, but it doesn't upset the believer, who knows, verse 14, that God has the full plan, the total design. So if you are merely earthbound, as atheists are, and I suppose agnostics, and many others who are searching and groping after the truth, if we are earthbound, then we are the victims, again and again, of despair and emptiness, but not the believer. There is this spiritual dimension which speaks to us of a creator, a redeemer, a savior of humanity, and of relationship at the heart of it all. So we look out anxiously from our world, and a voice comes reverberating to us across the centuries. It's the voice of divine revelation enshrined supremely in a man, a person, a good person, of humble parentage, of peasant stock, in Galilee, who owned nothing. But it was he who gave flesh and blood to the voice that was speaking. And what was the voice saying? It was saying, this is not an empty universe. This is not a machine. This is a person speaking to you. When we realize that there is meaning and relationship at the heart of our universe, and when we realize furthermore that the all-loving and personal God actually cares about this world, and then when it dawns upon our mind that this personal God has actually visited us in the person of Jesus Christ, his Son, and has himself suffered adversity, humiliation, and died and bled sacrificially to win us back to himself, away from our coldness and alienation. Realize that, and the whole of our worldview goes through a completely new transformation. It has to. It does. At last, our minds have accepted what our instincts were all along telling us was true. It begins with a hint. Someone just coming to church can do it. Meeting up with one or two people who are believers. Just a hint. Maybe these people who are telling me that I'm just a collection of biochemical reactions, maybe they could be mistaken. Maybe there just might be a personal God who wants me to call him Father, who invites me to follow this person, Jesus Christ, once dead, admittedly, but now, they say, alive, forever, as millions of these Christians affirm. Maybe. The Bible just could be right. Possibly I've been conned into believing a dustbin full of lies. Os Guinness, in his book, The Dust of Death, which some of you may have read before it went out of print, writes, there is always a tension between what a person says he is and who he is. And Os Guinness takes as an example the 18th and 19th century Japanese poet, Issa, whose own life was very sad. All five of his children died before he was 30, and then his wife died as well. After one of these deaths, he went to his master of Zen and asked him for an explanation of such suffering. And the Zen tutor answered him with these words, just as the sun rises and the dew evaporates, so on the wheel of suffering, sorrow is transient, life is transient, humans are transient. That was the religious answer he got. But on returning home, Issa wrote a poem which he could not finish. It began as he asked himself the question, is life just a drop of dew? No more. Is that it? He started the poem, the world is dew. The world is dew. And yet. And there the poem stopped. He got no further. That was as far as he could get. The and yet explained his dilemma. For Issa, the Orthodox Zen believer, life was just a drop of dew, nothing more. But for Issa, the father crushed by bereavement, for Issa, the agonized husband, crazy with grief, the sheer logic of his feelings and emotions told him that life must be more significant than just merely evaporating dew. I once heard Os Guinness comment that at this particular point in his book, where he explains Issa's dilemma, numbers of unbelieving intellectuals have changed their worldview and have become Christians there and then, that spot. Because, as they would say to the author later, Issa's experience confirms me in my experience. My own instincts tell me that life is more significant than what I've been telling myself to believe up to now. So far then, it was a matter of their minds at last catching up with what their instincts and emotions had been telling them was true all along the road. That's what we have to do. And what clinches it for so many of us is Christ. Christ, who in that Easter week was God in human form, dying upon that cross, accepting himself in himself the guilt and the desolation and the lostness of all of the human race. He knew it what it was to come into a world that was second best, and then to taste the degradation of much of life here, and then to see suffering people, then himself to suffer, though he was innocent and pure. So it reaches the point when at the end of Christ dying for our sins and being raised historically bodily on that third day, they were told that the good news of the gospel is to accept this Christ into our lives and to accept that he has borne our lostness in himself, that he has taken upon himself the moral responsibility for our failures so that we can be accepted by God now and forever. Don't even have to wait until we die to find out how we stand with God. We can know now. That's what we're told in the scriptures. So while the Christian accepts that this side of the grave does represent a second best, at the same time we are following someone who is perfection personified. And it's he who is the magnet. As we come to put our trust in him, as hundreds of us have done, because you've told me your stories, and I've told you mine too, how he puts his spirit in our lives, and we find that there is a dynamic given, and that life does begin to make sense, and we understand the context in which we've been set, and at last we've established our relationship to the whole of the universe. So this is a good moment to begin this relationship, if we're still fuzzy about it. We're here to help each other. With this reminder that God has put eternity into our minds, we were made for him, and until we make our peace with him, we shall always find ourselves uncomfortably dancing to the wrong tune. The greatest experience of life, I maintain, is at last to understand who I am, where I came from, what this place is for, and where I'm heading, and it can expect to end up. Listen to how it happened to one of the great atheists of our century, C.S. Lewis. "I know very well when," he says, "but hardly how the final step was taken. I was driven to Whipsnade one sunny morning. When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did. Yet I had not exactly spent the journey in thought, nor in great emotion. Emotional is perhaps the last word we can apply to some of the most important events," says C.S. Lewis. "It is more like when a man, after long sleep, still lying motionless in bed, becomes aware that he is now awake." The superficial interpretation, the cynical interpretation, we've come to move on from both those inadequate views of life to the one that centers in the eternal and personal God, who has finally revealed himself in the person of Jesus Christ, who beckons to us to accept him, to know him, to follow him. So I wonder, what are the circumstances that brought you to London? We're here now in London, You may be here just as a visitor, or you may have come to live here. Let's believe that God has his purpose for you and for me. To know his Son, to establish our relationship to the universe, to find ourselves, and to get onto that path, discipleship, and knowing him, with which all else pales into insignificance. It's that path that colors the whole of life. All of the things we shall be doing in London, whether you're here to study, whether you're here to look for a job, whether you're in a job already, whatever it may be. I propose that what we will do at the end of our service is for me to help those who are fuzzy about this matter of knowing Christ in a personal sense, knowing God. Let me help you. I've done it many times before. I think what we'll do tonight is this, a bit different perhaps. I'd like to have a little after meeting of about 7 minutes long at the close of this service. I think 7 minutes is enough. I have explained it, Christian beginnings, in 3 minutes. Let me give myself 7 minutes. I'll pop myself just behind you at the drums, I think. And we'll give ourselves 10 minutes for the place to get a little bit emptied out for the coffee. You can start to drift away. I'm not going to rush you out of the building. And then the drums and things can begin to be put away. While that's happening, you find yourself a little seat there. I don't mind where you have to come from. It'll take you 10 minutes anyway. Take a seat. I'll hang on until it looks as though we've got as many there as need to come. And then I'll give a short explanation about beginning, how we start. It'll be roughly along the lines of this little book that I once wrote, Making a Start, I've called it, which I've made available to people from time to time. I'll explain roughly how it is we can start, and even start tonight. Coming to the little after thing doesn't commit you to anything except just to listen to what I've got to say. Then if after that you want to take the little booklet from me, read up further, maybe have a word with me, you're certainly free to do so. If you want to take some further step of commitment, you certainly can. Tonight or on some future occasion. No time like tonight, though, when you're being surrounded by love and worship in this place. So I'll give that short time afterwards, 7 minutes. We'll give ourselves 10 minutes for the service to end and to be tidied up. If you come with a friend, and perhaps they are a believer, let the friend come with you. Sit together, bring each other. And then maybe somebody says, I'm not sure if I'm a believer or not. Will you come? Or there may be somebody who says, I think I've started, but I need to go over it again, like writing over in ink what's already been written in pencil. Please be my guest. I won't embarrass you. I'll just make it as helpful and easy, practical as I can. No time, like last day of September. So as we think about the words, one long second best, I balance it with the words of that individual. I didn't know I was lost until I was found.